I'm so pleased to see everybody here today, and a special shout out to the moms who are here today instead of going on the Halloween activities that many of us have at school. So we all have a strong commitment to this particular issue. What I want to do with my short time here is try to touch on some of the issues that my esteemed colleagues here have highlighted, and also really put it back a little bit into a healthcare frame. I want us to think for a few minutes about how far we've come, and we actually have come quite far, and then share with you some findings from the Kaiser Women's Health Survey to really kind of illustrate some of the points around women in healthcare, and then touch on a little bit some of the issues in the current policy debate, both here in Washington and also at the state level, where so much is going on. And both Marcia and Heidi didn't really go into very much of the really, really critical, important state work that their organizations do as well. And really, and with women's health, a lot of that is where the rubber hits the road these days. So where have we come from? We have come a very long way, and I just always find these timelines really interesting. We're standing on the shoulders of a lot of women who have done a lot of work. When you think about the fact that before 1972, only married women had the right to contraception. Unmarried women couldn't have access to contraception. 1982, for those of you who are researchers, the National Survey on Family Growth started including women of reproductive age, not just married women, in terms of understanding their reproductive health. 1985, we had the first Public Health Service Task Force report on women's health issues, thinking about society, until 1983 was the first time that we saw a lesbian character on a TV show. So really, it's been dramatic, and even moving forward to more recent times, in 1993 was the first time the NIH Revitalization Act required the inclusion of women in clinical research. We were just hearing that the White House Council on Women and Girls, now they're sponsoring women crash test dummies. Well, we still do dosing for drugs based on small men for women. So while we've made a lot of progress, we still have very far to go. And more recently, with the passage of health reform and with the new adoption of the preventive services for women, now for the first time we will have contraceptive coverage for women, coverage for, as we've heard earlier, intimate partner violence, coverage for breastfeeding support. So why are we still talking about women's health? You know, we've heard a lot about the economic issues. We know that sex also matters, that women, men, girls, cells, females have different manifestation of disease and response to treatment than men. We also know that women have distinct health needs. They use the health system in different ways. Their reproductive health also guides in many ways how they use the healthcare system and their needs for healthcare services. And we've heard today, gender matters too. Economics, work, family roles and responsibilities, social roles and society, it all makes a difference and all impacts health. So because we're here, and many of us are public health researchers, I put a nice framework here. This is from Dahlgren and Whitehead. This is from the report cited in the IOM report on the future of public health. And you can see the frame here where the social, economic, cultural, health, and environmental conditions and policies circle around our living and working conditions, social and family and community networks, our individual behaviors, as well as our innate traits. They all shape our health. They're all interrelated and they all cut across the lifespan. So we've heard a lot about women in poverty. This is just one more slide to an enormous body of research that really shows that the burden of illness and disability falls heaviest among low-income women. And this is consistent across all. And I put the high cholesterol in there because I think that relates to access to health care. You don't know if you have high cholesterol unless you can go to get tested. And so there are issues right now where there are conditions where we don't even know that there are disparities because people don't have access to care. Similarly, our ability to keep ourselves healthy, to do exercise, for example. I think this is really kind of an amazing slide, because even at the highest, the most highest exerciser, which are non-Hispanic white women, 19% of non-Hispanic white women exercise regularly. So, and you can see here the poverty gradient and also differences by race and ethnicity. So it's very difficult in terms of time and finding a safe place to exercise and somebody to watch your children while you're doing all of those things in terms of work to really stay healthy for many women. We've heard a lot about the ACA and how important it is, the role of coverage, and here you can see clearly that having coverage really does make a difference. Having access to health insurance coverage increases access to preventive services, but not completely. And you can see here that while having no insurance is a much higher barrier, and again, particularly for low-income women, 29% of low-income women said that they delayed or went without care they needed because they didn't have insurance. Many of them don't have doctors, but many women don't have time. They don't have the ability to take time off from work. Low-income women in particular have problems with child care and with transportation, and these are important issues that I think we need to consider as we're trying to promote access to care. We heard a lot about paid leave. It is women who are making the decisions and caring for not only their own health but their children's health. We've asked this of men, and when you ask this of men, it's interesting because the red bar doesn't really change the same. It's mostly the women, but the green bar, more of them say that there's shared responsibility. I always like that difference there. And we know that working moms, when their children are sick, we know that about half of them have to miss work because their child, they don't have no one else to take care of their child. And among those women, half of those women lose pay. And we heard so much about the importance of having paid leave when they when their own child is sick, not only their own health. We also know that women's work is really changing. We have women moving into more traditional, what we consider more traditionally male jobs, but we also are, there's research that's coming to light that show that women get injured more often, they recover less quickly from major illness and injury. Some studies have started to show that they have cardiovascular disease earlier than women in other positions, and they are more likely to experience harassment and discrimination. We also are the body of research around women's exposure to different chemicals and social risk factors. Really, we need to do a lot more work in terms of understanding the gender differences there. And we heard earlier about women in the military. We have 14% now of deployed women are in the military. I'm on an advisory committee at the VA and on women's health, and they kept talking about MST. PTSD, MST. Do people know what MST is? MST is the acronym that the VA uses for military sexual trauma. It's rape. And it's so common for women and for many men as well that it's now become an acronym. Everyone's still talking about how concerned they are about MST and dealing with MST in the VA. So these are really important issues that we really need to think about as women's work also changes. But another part of that we haven't really touched on is the important role that women play as caregivers. 12% of women are caregivers. 1 in 5 of those women are caregiving full-time over 40 hours a week. Usually it's to a frail or disabled relative, often a parent or an in-law. And we heard from Heidi in terms of the important role of Social Security. I always find this kind of shocking. In terms of the women's, the factors that really predispose women to long-term care, half of women in this country are living on incomes under, these are women over 65 on Medicare are living on incomes under $20,000. 39% of living them are living alone, 46% are widowed. And you can see here that those social supports are not there. These are women who need long-term care because they don't always have someone to look after them. The men often have the wives to look after them. And you can see here the difference in the longevity. And we heard about the important role of Social Security for women. Well, let me tell you, for Medicare and Medicaid, they are also critically important. Medicaid in particular is a program that is critical for women. And so right now we have a committee that's right down the street in this deficit commission with one woman on it, right, that are going to be making critically important decisions that affect the future of millions of women, 25.7 million women on Medicare and 23.3 million women on Medicaid. So that is really, I think, a critical issue. Similarly, around the reproductive rights issues, where we know that at the federal and the state level that these policies make a critically important difference for women in terms of access to abortion services, which is eroded almost on a daily basis at the state level, access to contraceptive services, where on one hand we have, I think, a bright spot in terms of the ACA future coverage of private plans and contraception, but at the other side we have Title X in many cases fighting for its life, and providers like Planned Parenthood are really struggling to stay afloat and really fight the challenges both at the federal and at the state level. This affects women's access to STI, HIV testing, and also important areas for maternal and child health, and also in terms of improving birth outcomes. So I think that we do have great opportunity. There's renewed attention. You know, the White House for the first time has this, you know, coordinating committee and really looking at these issues. But right now, the economic crisis has really zeroed in and put a very, very disproportionately heavy burden, I think, on women's issues. We have great opportunities through ACA, but we are going to have to be very vigilant to make sure that this law is implemented in a way that really protects women, that really delivers all of its promise. I think the reproductive health issues, I think back, you look at where we've been, and sometimes it feels like a little bit like we're going back to the future, but I do think that this is really an important area for those of us who are working in public health to really, really stay steady and strong on this issue. And then beyond health system issues, we really need to think about what it is to make it easier for women to have healthier lives in terms of their lifestyle, economics, supports for work, and in terms of family support. So with that.
Thank you so much. So we have about 15 minutes left in the session. Unfortunately, this microphone does not move, so you all can decide whether or not you'd like to shout or all pop up to answer questions. And we'll be taking questions, so if anyone has any, feel free to raise your hand and we'll see how many we can get through in the next 15 minutes. All right, I won't even go into mine, just let's get as many as we can. Come on. And can you identify yourself and speak very, very loudly?
I think the answer is Mother Jones, don't mourn, organize. I think the more we can get the policymakers to focus on increasing revenues, the better off we are. And I think that, you know, in survey after survey after survey, Tea Party members, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, the vast majority of all those groups do not want to see Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security benefits cut. So I think that there's an organizing opportunity around the fact that these members of Congress have to get reelected. So I think that the more women's groups, whether you're in health or in finance, whatever area you're in, the more you can get out there, I think, and push the women's angle, the better it is, because actually women are more likely to vote than men, and the politicians have learned that as well. So if we can, you know, echo, get a big enough echo chamber going and emphasize this enough, I think we can make a difference in the outcome of the super committee's work. I mean, interestingly enough, they're saying that if the super committee doesn't come to an agreement, the Republicans are going to organize to keep the automatic sequestration budget cutting from going into effect because they don't want to see the defense budget cut. Now, presumably, they're going to just defend the defense budget. I don't know. But that's definitely an organizing opportunity. In other words, you know, Congress passed the automatic cuts, but, you know, everybody's wondering, are they really going to happen or not? Because it's really a very, very fluid, very unsettling, uncertain political situation for Republicans and Democrats. They really don't know what to do. The only thing I can say is I think the Occupy Wall Street movement has definitely helped us. And so support the Occupy Wall Street movement as well.
Can I add a couple quick things, if you can hear me? And that is one of the things that public opinion research shows is that women are less likely to vote because they think that they aren't informed enough than men. Men seem to think that they have enough information to make decisions. So it's really, for those of you who have the expertise, the public health expertise, to write letters to the editor, to call into talk shows, to participate in Facebook and Twitter and all the social media with as many of your networks as you can, you actually have enormous credibility because of your expertise to explain what the impact of some of these suggestions and proposals would be. And that is so important. I will also say that the National Women's Law Center has an action alert system, many other organizations too. So if you went to nwlc.org, we would provide ways of getting involved and alerts about different issues that are coming to the fore. But those kinds of speaking out and informing people with whatever networks you have and with so many different ways of getting it amplified are really, really important for women to feel like they have the information so that they are, in a certain sense, entitled to speak out themselves and even vote.
I will put in a very selfish plug. I'm actually speaking at a presentation tomorrow on, it's through the maternal child health section on MCH advocacy, and we'll have very specific ideas of how to physically leave the conference and go to the Hill and have a meeting. So you should come. It's at 8:30. Next question. I'm in the blue.
I can respond to that a little bit. You might want to check out the website of the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, because there are some groups there that are targeting or that have members who are primarily young adults, students, and multi-generational groups as well. But actually, our data show, and most of the survey data show, that the impact of the recession is huge on younger adults. And the younger group are actually more supportive of Social Security than that slight middle group. Like 25 to 40 are the least supportive. All groups are supportive. That's the bottom line. Every group is supportive in the majority. But it's high at the older ends, and it's high at the younger ends, a little bit higher than in the middle. And I think this recession has had an enormous impact on children, our children, my adult children of that generation, Fortunately, my husband and I are employed, but there are many parents who lost their jobs and they only have Social Security. They are hanging on till they reach 62, so they have something. And those young adults know that that's what their parents are doing, and they know how important it is. So actually, in the last few years, we've seen those numbers rise for young adults in terms of support for Social Security. So it's just something to keep in mind. Don't feel hopeless about it. Actually, you know, you just look around and people say, whoa, look what's happening to my parents. This is really important to preserve this program.
Right back there. Yeah, you.
I have a couple comments. One is that with respect to reproductive health care in particular, one of the things that polls and research have been showing over many years is that people have not felt that at the end of the day, their access is really going to be threatened. In recent years, the level of threat has intensified, as you can well imagine. So there's kind of a two-edged challenge. One, for people to be informed enough to really know that this is a serious, serious threat in what is happening in state legislatures all over the country, in state referenda, including in Mississippi with this Life Begins at Conception initiative. But the second part, which is what I think that really is the part that you're getting to, is after knowing there's a threat, believing that you can make a difference. And that's where the showing of progress and people who demand and insist can make a difference. And it's the mobilizing, once people understand what the threats are, as well as the opportunities for progress, that is so important. So I do think these movements, whether it's Tea Party, where, as you could imagine, much of what they have seemed to be interpreted as supporting, which is not to cut back on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, but somehow that is how their support seems to be translating. Or now the Occupy Wall Street kind of movement is a beginning of a reflection of people standing up and insisting and demanding on being to be heard. When the Planned Parenthood attacks began,
They now have, I think, a network of over 6 million people who responded. And so there is a beginning to be encouraged of both the knowledge of what the threats are and then what collective action really can do to make a difference.
I think you raise a really excellent point, and I have struggled over this particular issue as well, because we have a whole separate system in this country of, you know, family planning providers and abortion providers, because the mainstream medical community didn't provide these services for women. They weren't there. And so it's really important to protect this, but I think we also need to put some responsibility on the medical provider to say these are essential services as part of women's health care, so that we can't have them hanging out here ready to be axed by people who, for whatever reason, don't believe that they are important. So I think we need to do kind of, it has to be kind of two efforts. One is to really preserve this network that really serves women, young women, teens, who don't really feel comfortable necessarily going into the mainstream medical community, but also getting the mainstream medical community to really kind of come to the table and say, okay, women need contraceptive services, women need screening for all these services, women need abortion services. These are important medical services for women, and they can't be separate. So in some level, we've kind of fallen victim to these providers have fallen victim to the, because they're separate and because there were gaps there, they are really being attacked. So I think we kind of need to put pressure not only on preserving those, but getting the mainstream medical community to really ante up for women. And I think that's an area that we, I think, haven't done enough. It's been kind of the OBGYNs, and that's it.
So I'm sorry, unfortunately we've just run out of time, but I too could stay here and talk to these wonderful women all day. I would like to invite everyone to show your appreciation. And I certainly encourage you to go to their websites. They all have listservs and action alerts and all sorts of things that can really help you stay engaged. Thank you.
I would just like to add a thanks to Ariane. She talked about being starstruck, but she is one of the people that I was struck by. I think her fellowship hadn't even concluded when the congresswoman she was working for hired her as her health policy associate. So that's a pretty impressive record. And also thanks to Elena Ong, who helped us organize this, and Jessica from the Women's Caucus.